From burnout and exhaustion to joy and fulfillment. Through the act of serving consciously, it's time to rediscover your passion. It's live with Elizabeth and guests on the Contact Talk Radio Network.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Serving Consciously. I'm your host, Elizabeth Bishop, and I'm so pleased that you're able to join us here today. As you know, the second and fourth Friday, when we talk about serving consciously, we are talking about what that actually means in relation to the conscious service approach, which is something I developed a few years ago. And, of course, if you want to learn more about that, you can always go to my website through servingconsciously.com, and you'll find lots of information there. And over the last several months, we've talked a lot about, you know, traditional forms of service, say in healthcare or human services, and we've also talked about alternative approaches like energy work and Reiki and things like that. And more recently, in the last few shows, we started looking at service as an energy that we just simply step into and express in relationship to others, regardless of what form that might take. And one of the goals in service to others is often that development of resilience, the ability to bounce back from life's challenges. And it's also a key factor in our capacity to be conscious service providers ourselves and that ability to be resilient in our own lives. So today we're going to take a deep dive into what it means to be resilient, among some other things. And I'm really excited to be introducing you to my guest today. His name is Jean-Paul Bedard. And he is an author, advocate, and elite endurance athlete. Named one of the 50 most influential Canadians by Huffington Post, Jean-Paul has used his profile as a public figure to speak candidly about being a survivor of childhood sexual abuse and of his battles with addiction and mental health issues. A veteran of over 140 marathons and ultra-marathons, Jean-Paul received the Golden Shoe Award as the 2015 Canadian Runner of the Year. Jean-Paul is also a featured contributor to Huffington Post, a columnist with iRun magazine, and his best-selling book, Running Into Yourself, was released earlier this year by Breakaway Books of New York. You can read more about Jean-Paul's incredible journey of resiliency by following his popular blog, Breathe Through This, and you can find that at breathethroughthis.com, which has over 5 million readers and subscribers. A sought-after public speaker, Jean-Paul is known for his ability to infuse humor in his talks as he speaks candidly about coming to terms with serious issues such as addiction, depression, and trauma. Jean-Paul passionately believes life is not about what happens to us, but about what we do with what happens to us. His is a message of hope, strength, and resiliency. And I'm so pleased and excited and honored to welcome you here today, Jean-Paul.
Oh, thank you for having me, Elizabeth. I'm really looking forward to this.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. So I'm wondering if you could tell us a bit more about your journey and how you came to be doing the kind of work that you're doing right now.
Well, it's kind of funny. I was speaking earlier today at a friend's five-year medallion at a 12-step meeting at lunchtime. And, the bitter irony of those types of meetings is that you tend to kind of dig into a little bit of your life history that brought you into a 12-step room dealing with an addiction. So I have had a little bit of time today to reflect on how I got to where I got. So it's kind of an interesting thing to continue this conversation, but now in a different venue. But I grew up.
It's a theme.
It's a theme, all right. I grew up in Toronto, and I'm the youngest of five kids. And there's quite a big difference in ages between the kids. And by the time I came along, the relationship was pretty much over at that point for my parents. But one of the things that was going on in the house was that my mom was dealing with some mental health issues. And my childhood was a very violent childhood. And from a very young age, I can remember always being scared at home and being afraid of my mom. And one of the things I would do from a very young age, and I continued it right up until she left when I was, I think grade 7. But I would go into my room at night, and I would get my hands, and I'd push them into my eyes, and I would hold them there for as long as I could, and then I'd take my hands away, and those little white stars would dance in front of my face. Mm-hmm. And I can remember thinking, this is when I feel safest. It's when I kind of take myself away from where I am and what I'm feeling. And that kind of has been a theme that's carried right throughout my life. It carried through my addictions when I went to drugs and alcohol as a way to get away from what I was feeling. And, you know, in sobriety, I started running, and that was another kind of way of getting away from how I'm feeling. And so it's like the last 4 or 5 years, my life has really been about no longer escaping. And that's why I titled the book that I had written, Running Into Myself, because that's what I was doing. I was trying not to run away anymore. I was trying to run towards the stuff that scared me most. One of the ways that I escaped as a kid was into athletics. And I was always, you know, quite a gifted athlete. And I captained the hockey team and the baseball team, and played a lot of like other sports. But I was really good in track because I was fast. But on the outside, it looked like things were going well. I was, you know, doing well and fairly well in school. And I was, you know, one of the big athletes in the city. And things looked good, but I went from that being that kid who was excelling in sports to being a 14-year-old lying on a hospital gurney in a hospital in downtown Toronto from my second drug and alcohol overdose. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where the story really picks up. It really picks up with the addictions.
Yeah. I love how you set the stage there though too, just like, you know, people can look at things like, it seems obvious when we get into addictions with drugs or alcohol, things like that as a form of escaping, that it's obvious that that's a, you know, also a sort of a path of self-destruction. But sometimes people don't see things like running or doing things in a healthy way, that's something that's constructive, as also being a way that we can escape. But it's so true, isn't it?
Well, I mean, We can kind of dive into this a little bit as we're going on in the conversation, but I do a lot of public speaking. As an elite athlete, I'm privileged to have a platform where I can talk about mm-hmm. things. And mm-hmm. most recently, I started talking about the stuff that people don't like talking about and the stuff that I didn't want to talk about for most of my life. And that's kind of the mental health issues and a lot of the issues around sexual violence that I've, you know, now become quite outspoken about. But one of the things that I've come across is about 4 or 5 years ago, I came across the work of someone who I'm sure you're familiar with out west, Dr. Gaber Maté.
Yes.
And I mean, he's such an amazing guy. And so I've recently celebrated 20 years clean and sober. So I've spent thousands of hours in church basements and in halls and dark places, listening to 12-step meetings going on and on and on. And in all of that time, in all of those hours, I'd never heard what was said when I spoke to Dr. Maté. And that's when he says, and he, you know, is quite well known for saying this, that the opposite of addiction is not sobriety. The opposite of addiction is connection.
Yes.
And it's a lesson that's taken me a long time in my, you know, my years of active drug and alcohol use. Obviously I was too numbed out to deal with it, but like I'm shocked that it took me that long, almost, you know, 16 years into my sobriety before I finally made the mental leap that what I was seeking most was not escape, but connection. And so it really has helped calibrate my sobriety, in that now I realize whenever I'm feeling like I might slip, or whenever I feel a little bit tenuous in my mental health and in my sobriety, the number one resource for me now is connection. I reach out and when I see other people struggling, a lesson that I've learned is the importance of reaching in. And very often we feel embarrassed about reaching into someone when, you know, he or she is obviously struggling, because we think it's not our place, or we're worried about being preachy or overstepping the boundaries. But I know from my work in the mental health field how important it is to reach into people. And one of the things that I've come to realize, especially around the issue of my childhood trauma that I'm working through, is that people aren't really broken. And I used to say this a lot about myself, that, you know, I was really broken, or I needed to get fixed. But I don't think people are generally broken. I think what they are is they are a little bit disconnected and a little bit lost. And by starting to see myself as not broken, it really allowed me to access that resilience that I believe lies within all of us. And it was just something that I thought was not available to me because for some reason I was defective, I was broken, I was, you know, unfixable.
I love that you said that because I so totally agree with that. And there's so much of what you just said there that I want to pick up on. But I think for, you know, for me, with my background in, you know, has been in human services and adult education around human services, and now this whole concept of looking at what it means to be of service in the world to other people, I think that that's one of the key myths that needs to be busted. The fact that any of us, no matter what our life circumstances, are broken at the core, because we're not. And I always feel like one of the most powerful things we can do when we are, like you said, reaching out to others and connecting in with others to be of service, whatever we want to call it, is that capacity to hold the vision, you know, to hold the vision of someone's wholeness, including our own, which is just beautiful.
And you know, and just to kind of take that a little bit further, what you're mentioning there is one of the things that I've learned being around 12-step programs for a long time is this really core belief that I think is important for me, that in order to help another person, and this is the entire kind of structure of self-support groups, is that in order to help another person, you don't necessarily need to have a PhD.
Yeah.
You just need to be present. You just need to be around people. And absolutely, I mean, if you follow my journey, you know that I am completely connected to a professional care team of trauma specialists, you know, between therapists and psychiatrists and doctors and that whole realm of professional support. But one of the pillars for me in my life has been the professionals that have been there to be my lifeboat, my parachute, whatever you want to call it. And so I think quite often when we see someone struggling, it's almost this excuse that we have that, you know what, I may not say the right thing or I may not do the right thing. And so that may just come down to the fact that, you know what, you don't need a PhD to fix everything. You just need to be willing to listen. And so that's been a huge for me in the last few years.
Yes. And that whole, what you just said about being present and engaged. And when I talk about conscious service, that's really a big piece of it too. Like I you know, it's not about theories. The whole, potential for transformation to occur, the potential for growth, expansion, healing, that all happens between human beings. And, you know, all the other stuff, theories and practices and research, all of that is great, but that's not really where the meat of it is. Mm-hmm. And so I totally agree with you. And one of the big aspects of being conscious in service, from my perspective, is around self-connection. And I think that's a lot of what you're talking about there too, being able to connect to who you are in order to bring presence to other people.
Yeah, we can get into this stuff too, but as an endurance athlete, I run a lot, right? I mean, I run further distances than most people would drive in a week. So I typically will log upwards of 200 to 230 kilometers a week of running.
And
that's a lot. That's a lot. And it's a long time to be out there doing it, because I never run on a treadmill. I'm always outside.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the questions I typically get asked when I speak in the Q&A part is, you know, what do you listen to when you're out there for that long? Or what's the big question is, what's going through your mind? So I think this comes back to your question in a roundabout way. My response is always that I don't run to music. I've never run with any kind of device, an iPod or anything like that. Number one, because it's for my own safety, being out on the road for 4 or 5 hours at a time, I need to be aware of what's happening around me. But more importantly, it's forced me to have that emptiness in my head long enough that I have to pay attention to myself. And the most beautiful thing about running for 4 or 5 hours and sometimes longer at one stretch is that you are alone with yourself. However, the flip side of that coin is when you are running for 4 or 5 hours by yourself, you are alone with yourself and you cannot escape it. And I have one of those monkey brains and all of that stuff. I'm the guy in the yoga class who's lying on the mat during Shavasana, just thinking about a million things instead of just settling into my body. And I get frustrated with that, but that's okay. I mean, I've learned to be patient with that part of me. So I really identify with this idea that you're talking about, this self-awareness. And self-awareness is a tricky thing, right? Because self-awareness has, in my mind, the potential for me to get self-critical. When I get self-critical, it's typically because I think I should be further along whatever it is, you know, further along in my athletics that I want to be in professionally, socially, in terms of, you know, my mental health, all of these things. It's when I'm not happy with where I'm at now. And as a recovering addict, my number one default is, oh my God, this feels uncomfortable. How can I numb it away?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the amazing lessons that I've learned through dealing with the professionals when it comes to my mental health is something that I never figured out on my own, and something that being in my, you know, recovery groups and things like that, we didn't really talk about there either. But the professionals are showing me that there's no such thing as what is referred to as selective numbing. And that's when I can say, I'm feeling really horrible about this in my life. So I'm going to use drinks, drugs, shopping, sex, gambling, whatever distraction you put in there to numb it, to get rid of that bad feeling. But it's not like you're going to the dentist and you can put this shot into your gum that's going to numb out just part of your body. The thing with when you numb yourself out like that is you numb out everything. And that was the critical thing I had to come to terms with as an addict, is that when I numb out these bad feelings, I numb out all feelings. And the way out of these negative feelings is connection. So by going to that default of numbing things out, I'm numbing out the love, I'm numbing out the support, and all of the kind of bridges to get me back to the connection that I really need in order to move forward.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I think that that's sometimes we learn that through, like you said, connecting with other people, the professionals, and having someone point it out. And sometimes you notice it through, you know, just the experiences that you have in life. And I remember at one point in my life, a significant traumatic point when I lost my brother, and having that realization that I wanted so badly to be away from the feeling that of grief and loss and what was happening. But just recognizing that there was no way I would be able to experience my capacity for joy again if I didn't let myself feel it, you know?
I just, you bring up joy, and I just finished reading, and I'm not getting any money to plug this. I wish I were. I just finished reading Sheryl Sandberg's new book, Plan B, where she talks about coming to, and Sheryl Sandberg's, for people who don't know, is the CEO, I believe, of Facebook. And I'm not sure if you remember this, but about 4 years ago, Sheryl was down south with her husband on just a little getaway, and her husband dropped dead on the treadmill. Tragically, I think he's quite young. He was right around 40 or early 40s. Completely unexpected, and he was healthy in all accounts. And there was quite a period of time where people thought that she and the doctors had thought that he had fallen and died as a result of the fall, because he was alone at the time. And then subsequently they discovered that he had had heart issues that they hadn't diagnosed. But so she's written this book called Plan B, and it's recently come out, and she's around promoting it everywhere. But what she's talking about in the book is the resilience needed to get through grief and that kind of loss and trauma that way. And it's just been an amazing, amazing book, and I can't recommend it enough to people. And one of the things that she points out, and it's something else that I've come across, is that when we are feeling alone, or particularly when we've lost a relationship or we've lost a loved one, what we often do is we avoid the behaviors and the activities that we used to engage in that would remind us of that person, because we don't want to in any way compound the grief. And what ends up happening is, in so doing, in order to protect ourselves from further grief, we start making our life smaller, and we start pushing away those things that used to bring us joy. Like, so for instance, when I think about my wife, Marianne, one of the things that we've been doing for years, and we've been married for coming up to 30 years.
Wow.
This summer, is we see one or two movies every weekend, usually in the afternoons. And I don't know why, but it just makes me happy just sitting beside her in a movie theater. And I can really identify that, God forbid, if anything were to happen, where I would naturally want to pull away from that activity, going to movies, because they would remind me of the person who I loved and who I now had such great loss for. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. the problem in doing that is we deprive ourselves of the joy that really helps us get through the grief. So, when I sobered up, I pulled away from sports, right? Because I used to associate sports with drinking.
Yes.
And it wasn't until about a year and a half into my sobriety where I really started to throw myself back into sports and allow myself that presence. And like my belief was that when people watch sports or when people are engaged in team activities or whatever it is, that everybody's drinking. Everybody's getting loaded all the time.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. I was drinking. I was getting loaded all the time. And probably the other addicts involved in it were doing the same thing. But that's just not normally the case. And I'm so glad that I allowed or invited that joy that I get from athletics back into my life, because it became the catalyst to getting forward.
Absolutely. And obviously one of the places too where you find a deep sense of self-connection, which to me is like self-awareness on steroids.
Yeah.
But intended. But do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Where really going beyond just I'm going to pick out what's great about me or what's not so good and I'm going to get critical, but I'm instead going to be present and just connect to whatever it is that's going on inside of me, body, mind, spirit, and be present for it. So then I'm present for other people in a deeper way as well. Mm. Let's take a quick break and then we'll come back and carry on our discussion, because there's so much more I would like to talk to you about as far as resilience and some of the other things you've already mentioned. So we'll take a quick break and we'll be right back. You're listening to Serving Consciously and I'm your host, Elizabeth Bishop, and we'll see you in a minute.
Is part of your life mission to be of service to others? Making a difference in the world is a tall order. You are the resource when it comes to serving humanity. Beyond taking care of yourself, learn to create self-connection in your life. Integrate who you are with what you do. You will find a source of inspiration and energy that surpasses your wildest imagination. Register for the Self-Connection Series at www.elizabethbishopconsulting.com. Look under Programs and Services for details. Are you a helping professional looking for inspiration, resources, and community? Visit socialworkhelper.com for relevant articles and learning opportunities. Connect with other difference makers in the world. socialworkhelper.com.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Serving Consciously. I'm your host, Elizabeth Bishop, and today we're talking with JP Bedard, and we're talking about resiliency and a lot of other things, actually, in this first 20 minutes or so. But JP, I'd like to ask you how you define resilience. What does that mean for you?
Well, sort of the backstory of that is, you know, I had been sober about 16 years at the time, and this was about 4 years ago. And that's when I finally, I don't know, arrived at a place in my life where I felt that I could deal with the real issue of my life. And that's the fact that I'm a survivor of childhood sexual abuse. Mm-hmm. And that's when I started talking to my wife about it and getting the help that I really needed to work through those issues of that, you know, embedded trauma, that untreated trauma, all of that. And that's when I really started to understand resilience. And so because of my position as an athlete and being privileged to get up in front of groups and do a lot of public speaking, and I started talking about some of the issues that I was dealing with. I started talking about the childhood sexual abuse and the addiction issues and the mental health issues that I had struggled with earlier in my life. And people would come up to me after I finished speaking and they would, quietly disclose a few things to me. And typically people would say things like, JP, you're so strong, or JP, you're so resilient. Mm-hmm. And they would say all these things and I would look and, you know, uncomfortable and say, thank you so much. And then I would go back to my house or back to the hotel if I was not at home, and I would cry, or I would just feel like such a fraud. And I just, because I couldn't see the resilience in myself, but everybody kept telling me that I had it. And so I decided about a year and a half ago to write a book about resilience. And the process has been to interview well over 100 people from around the world. And these are quite well-known people and other people who aren't as well-known, but people who have these amazing stories of sustained and incredible resilience in their lives. And I, you know, have finished the interview process just recently, and it's been over 350 hours sitting down with people. Wow. And certain themes have come up, obviously that they would, but I wasn't sure what they would be going into the project. And so here's my belief about resilience as I'm moving forward in the writing part of this process right now. So number one thing that I've learned is that we don't see our own resilience. And I won't mention anybody at this point because it's, I don't want to out them, but there are some quite famous people who, you know, if you'd hear their name, you would say, oh my God, that person is so amazing, so strong. I would have conversations with these individuals where the first half an hour would be trying to convince either the man or the woman who I'm speaking with that they are strong. And from the outside, everybody would say, oh my gosh, of course that person is strong. But we don't see our own resilience. And this is why it's so important. And this ties a lot into the fact of, you know, why support groups and peer groups work so well, is that we see our resilience when we see it reflected to us through others. And that's why it's really important to be in community. So I think that was the first thing, that people don't see their own resilience. The second thing, and this is something that I've come to really understand personally, is that I see resilience as being available to every single human being.
And I agree.
The problem is we doubt that it lies within us. Mm-hmm. The other problem is, we usually only see glimpses of it when we are at the precipice of trauma, adversity, or loss.
Yes.
So it's one of these amazing qualities that lies within us. Unfortunately, in order to have access to it, things have to go off the rails in your life. And so we all kind of don't want that to happen. Another important thing about resilience is that I've started to believe resilience is like a reservoir that lies within us. And like any kind of reservoir, if you constantly consume it, if you just use it up and you don't replenish it, eventually it's dry and there's nothing available to you until you start to replenish it again. Yes. So what I have seen in my own life and in the conversations that I've had with people is that just because you were resilient in the past, or just because you may be very resilient right now in the present, it doesn't mean that going forward, if something else were to come into your life, that throws you off the rails, that you would continue to be resilient unless you are replenishing the reservoir. So the four main themes to have come out of these interviews come down to these four qualities. The first being community. So number one means that you cannot have resilience really apparent to you unless you are connected to other people, to a support group, to other people who are going through similar things. And that's why when we have cancer survivors, people who are in grief counseling, 12-step groups, all of these communities of fellow travelers, we really see that community is important in terms of nurturing resilience. Mm-hmm. The next important quality that came out of these interviews was this idea of being able to adopt a mindset of overcoming. Now, when I say that, I have to be careful and kind of put the rider on this clause, being that when you have this mindset of overcoming, it does not mean that you are immune to adversity. There's no such thing as being bulletproof.
No.
And it doesn't mean that you will put something behind you and just move on. And it doesn't mean that you won't spend a great deal of your time treading water.
Yeah.
And all of the people I spoke to had at some point in their life and continue at points of their life to tread water, where it really feels like you're making no progress. You're really just mired in the trauma, the loss, or whatever's in front of you. But overall, there's this theme in their life and in my life of overcoming, that eventually I'm going to be in a better place.
Yes.
Whatever that may look like. And I never know what that will look like. And I think most people don't know what it looks like. And then the third quality that came up in the interviews was the importance of ritual. And now ritual speaks a lot to this idea of replenishing that resilience reservoir. So for me, ritual comes down to self-care of connecting with my body. So as a survivor of sexual violence, I have had a very distorted relationship with my body for quite some time, where I thought I was dirty, unworthy, all of these things. And so for many years into my sobriety with my running, it was a way of disconnecting from that body, of just kind of pushing everything away. But more recently, it's become a way for me to actually fall back into that body, to connect to it. So I think no matter what's going on in my life, the number one thing I do is whatever needs to happen to make me feel a little more resilient, a little more grounded. It comes down to that idea of, you know, you put your own oxygen mask on first before you reach out and you help your child or another passenger on the plane. It's very much like this. So the people I have spoke to had some type of ritual in their life, be it yoga, being in contact with nature. For many people, it was extreme endurance. It can be anything, but there has to be a ritual of self-care.
Mm-hmm.
And that feeds into this idea of overcoming. It's because you've replenished that reservoir. And then the final quality that was coming up, and this was really amplified in the people I was speaking to, was empathy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I get back to my own life and I think for so many years with the addictions and the stuff that I was going through, I was disconnected from people. And ultimately, the greatest gift that I've ever had in my life is being able to connect with another person and many other people on a way where I meet them where they are. Very much as though I had to learn to meet myself where I was. And I think that speaks to this idea of empathy. So it's not surprising when we have people who go through severe trauma, adversity, or loss. Say we have 10 people who go through a very similar trauma. We will see, you know, 3 out of those 10 people who are absolutely destroyed by that trauma and really do have a difficult time getting back on track.
Mm-hmm.
And then we will see, another 2 or 3 who really, you know, seem to find a better place for the trauma and in some way lead a more healthful life after it. But then we see a group of people who, not right away, but eventually take that trauma or that loss or adversity and they make meaning out of it. Yes. And these are the individuals who, you know, become advocates. These are the people who, start working with other cancer survivors. Or I saw this a lot. I interviewed, one of the most heartbreaking parts of this process was interviewing parents who had lost children to suicide or to a very sudden and tragic accident. And the individuals who I thought were, I hate this word thriving because it's just, it makes you feel guilty if you're not thriving. So I don't want that shame-based word, but whatever word we can all come up to that describes this way of living healthfully. I don't know what it is, but those parents who I talked to were parents who had, in some way kept their child alive by connecting with other parents who are going through a similar experience. One of the most amazing individuals who I've become so close with in this process and who I now consider a very dear friend of mine is Carol Todd. Now, Carol Todd is the mother of Amanda Todd, and Amanda Todd took her life after some very, extensive and prolonged cyber bullying and exploitation. Now, it would be really easy for Carol to just crumble and collapse, but she has become this beacon of resilience and hope for not only other parents who are struggling with this kind of a loss, but you know what? Remarkably, for kids, teens and adolescents who are, on that sort of precipice of feeling completely untethered. And so when I think about the people I interviewed for this book, many of them have become incredibly empathetic people who are really reaching in and out to other people.
Yeah.
But here's the hard part of that coin. That individuals who are very empathetic, and I think many of these people are, you tend to take on a lot of other people's trauma, strain, and loss. And so that speaks a lot to this idea of being able to constantly look after your own self-care and to replenish your own resilience reservoir, because it's very easy to get distracted and lost in other people's trauma as a way of kind of numbing yourself out from your own. And I know that from my own, right? So I've become somewhat of an international advocate for survivors of sexual abuse. And particularly, I get contacted a lot by parents, and especially parents of young boys who have recently disclosed or something has come to light, asking, what can they do, or how does this look? And I'm sure for many of these parents, I am one of two things. I'm kind of the ghost of Christmas future, where it's like, you look at my life and you can see that, the mental health issues, the suicide attempts, the years of drug and alcohol addiction, and all those like horrible kind of things that could lie in the future. But I'm also, I believe, somewhat of a beacon of hope. I've come out the other side of that, and I'm trying to make meaning of it.
Yes.
And so it's a constant thing, but I do believe ultimately that we are all, able to access resilience. It's just a matter of allowing it into our lives. And it's a scary thing, right? It's a scary thing if you think, I crumbling is not an option for me. So if I'm not going to crumble, I have to somehow sit in this till I get to a place where I can, make something of it. And that is the hardest part. That's the treading of the water.
Absolutely. So, yeah.
There's a great quote in that Sheryl Sandberg book, Plan B, where she says, resilience is not about having a backbone. It's about strengthening the muscles around the backbone.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we all have the backbone. We all have that resilience. Where the difference lies in our life is how much we are willing to do the ugly, messy work of building those muscles around that backbone.
Absolutely. And just where, our own awareness comes in the moment to be able to see the opportunities that are there for us to do it,
Yeah.
I just totally agree with you. You said so many amazing things there. I think, when you were talking in the beginning about the fact that we don't see our own resilience And, you know, then we start to, you know, maybe have that mirrored back to us through other people. But I think it's, and also that the glimpses we get are always when we're in that, the thick of it, right? In the adversity, in the trauma, in the tragedy. And we start to get the glimpses or start to recognize it through that process. But quite often, and I know for myself and for people, you know, that I have known over the years and family members and things like that, feeling, you know, someone saying, oh, you're so strong. And oh my gosh, can't believe how strong you are. And, but not feeling that way at all, you know, having no connection to that sense of strength that other people are identifying for you, you know?
Yeah.
And the empathy part that you spoke about too, I think is really, really powerful. You know, for people who are listening, who see themselves as being service providers in the world, quite often, I mean, that's one of the key features, right, is to have empathy and to be able to connect and relate to the experiences, the emotional experiences of other people. But when we absorb that and become enmeshed in that, then we are actually losing our capacity to be of service, and we're not, you know, not demonstrating compassion to ourselves.
Yeah.
Not engaging in self-love. And really that's that foundational stuff that you're talking about. Like, what is it that I need to care for myself so that I can keep replenishing that reservoir of resiliency that you identified?
And I think it's so much a human condition that we always think other people are deserving of worthiness, but we don't often give it to ourselves.
And that's the key. I'm learning more and more and more that is the key. And especially, I think for everybody, you know, for everybody it is. It's key that we start with ourselves first, and that it's not always just so we can continue to give and be of service. Something that I think is really common for people who work in service to others is the greater comfort we have with giving than we have with receiving.
Yes.
So not just so we can do more, but just because we are and we're here and we want to help ourselves feel good, you know? And feel better and feel nurtured. I think it's so powerful.
Mm.
It's beautiful. I can't wait for that book.
Yeah. I'm dying to get it too.
Let's take another quick break and then we'll come back and talk about a few other things I'd like to fit in before we wrap up today. So you're listening to Serving Consciously. I'm Elizabeth Bishop and we'll be right back with JP Bedard.
Okay, you're clear.
Awesome. Oh, it's so good, JP.
Oh, this is great. I'm really enjoying it. I hope I'm not rambling on too much. I'm trying to keep
on
topic.
You're not. Like, I'm just, sometimes I have to remind myself, okay, I'm going to have to eventually speak again because I'm listening so, so deeply to what you're saying. But my nephew, died by suicide almost 12 years ago. So when you were talking, it was just like, oh my God, like there's so many little snippets there. And just in what she's done as well, as far as keeping Stephen's memory alive and connecting with other parents and connecting with other families.
All right, stand by. Here we go.
Yeah, it's awesome.
And you're live.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Serving Consciously. I'm Elizabeth Bishop, and today we're talking with Jean-Paul Bedard, and we're talking about resilience and developing resilience and what it means and the different ways that we can connect to ourselves and continue to build up those reservoirs of resilience. Now, JP, I want to ask you, because I know that you provide workshops for, you know, for police, for first responders and other professionals responding, you know, in sexual assault investigations. And I'm just wondering what some of those key messages are that you'd like to share with those service providers and that you could share with us right now.
Oh, boy. How many owls do we have?
I know.
That's an interesting question, and it's a really, really pertinent question. I think we can all agree that when we see the media reports about what's happening right now in terms of responding to childhood sexual assaults, and then, you know, sexual assaults in the workplace, and just sexual violence in general, I don't know if we're doing a great job. And when I speak with the police, particularly, kind of the message that I'm getting back is that they feel often that they're taking the brunt of court outcomes that may not go the way that people want them to go. They may not feel that they're getting the justice and the resolution that they want. And I think what we need to remember is that when the police respond to a call of sexual violence or an assault, they are simply the bridge between the individual who has survived the assault and the justice system. They're kind of that thing in the middle where it's really not an envious place to be at, because it's really a no-win situation. Mm-hmm. Some of the things that I'm hearing from detectives and officers who are responding is that when they arrive at the door and they're going to be taking someone's statement, they are feeling all of that kind of awkwardness and that difficult feeling that we all feel when we are sitting in front of someone who has just gone through a horrendous experience. We are terrified to say the wrong thing, to do the wrong thing. So I think, and I believe, because I spent a lot of time, you know, giving workshops, you know, speaking in front of audiences, and half the time I feel that I'm really just speaking inside these silos. So I'll be in a room full of, you know, healthcare professionals talking about mental health. And, you know, really the people who need to be hearing this are not the people who are in the room. Or I'll be in, you know, a workshop or a community setting where I'm talking about responding to sexual violence, and the room is just full of survivors of sexual violence. So I think one of the things that I find has really been a signpost that I'm trying to move towards in what I'm doing is bringing in all of the stakeholders. And that means bringing in the police, bringing in the courts, bringing in the survivor of sexual violence, and here's the really awkward part, bringing in the perpetrator.
Yeah.
And it's not a discussion, it's not an arena where a lot of people feel comfortable. But I know from my own life as an endurance athlete, some of the most amazing things to have happened to me, to have happened inside of me, have arrived when I've been at the most uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So I think that's kind of the first thing. It's just that we really need to think about how to respond to that. Another important issue, and I'm sure you'll get this a lot when you talk to people, is the terminology. The word victim is a really, really loaded word. And one of the things that happened in my life, I mean, I'm a survivor of childhood sexual abuse, and I'm an advocate for other survivors, and I talk openly about it all the time. And a few years back, we had someone in the family who had a personal encounter with sexual violence, and I still wasn't really prepared with being able to help out in that situation. So what ends up happening is we reported the sexual assault. The police arrived to the house. The individual was interviewed by the police. And then as the police left, you know, and we were arranging to go do a video deposition later on, the police put down a card on the table that said victim services and the contact information. So here's what happened in a very short period of time. And this is what happens to every individual who survives an assault. You go from being average everyday life, whatever that looks like, to suddenly enduring extensive trauma, to that feeling of dissonance. And now all of a sudden you have been labeled a victim.
Yeah.
Because there's no better word for it that we have at this point. And it's just a way, you know, the system responds. And so much of my healing and other people's healing is trying to get from that word victim to survivor. And it's hard to even think of yourself as a survivor, because it feels so much as though the trauma never ends. Mm-hmm. And it comes down to three things that mean trauma stays embedded. And this is something that I've come to in my own sort of research around resilience from my book. And it's from Martin Seligman's work, these three P's of cognitive change. And they are personalization, pervasiveness, and permanence. So at any point, if we have one of these three P's, you know, operating within our life, it's really difficult to get away from the trauma, to not be embedded in it. So for instance, we think about a survivor of sexual violence, personalization, right? It's my fault.
Right.
Right? pervasiveness. Everything in my life is terrible. Everything has been destroyed. Permanence. Things will never get better. My life is over. So a lot of the work that I do with, you know, other survivors of sexual violence, the interactions that I have with people recovering from drug and alcohol addiction is trying to remind people that these three things, personalization, pervasiveness, and permanence are, you know, the trifecta of lies that our brain tries to tell us.
And it ends up creating an identity, and that's not the identity that we want to live by, right?
Right. And I'm not naive saying that I don't slip into those three P's myself, but I know when I get on the other side of whatever thing I've been dumped into, typically it's because I've made some peace with either personalization, pervasiveness, or permanence.
Beautiful. That's so powerful, JP, and so, so very true. And I love what you've said there. I mean, I'm sure that I feel like we could talk all afternoon. There's so much there. And I just wanted to make sure that people know where to find you before we wrap up today. This has been just an absolutely so informative and enlightening conversation. Wow. You can look for JP on his website at runjprun.com. And you can also find JP on Twitter and Instagram with those same handles, right? Run
yes.
JP Run. And what I'll do as well is put up your contact information on my website so people can go to servingconsciously.com where the replay for the interview that we've done today will be posted and all of your contact information there as well. And anything in our last minute here that you'd like to announce to people that's going on for you?
Well, I'm working on this book, Geography of Resilience, and that'll be out probably sometime next year. But, you know, I'm going to move away from self-promotion. And I want to close with, I think, the most important part of this. And that is, if there is anyone who is struggling out there, or if there's anyone who thinks that I can be of service or an ear in any way, I want you to contact me. And I'm really easy to contact. I'll even give you my email. It's runjprun@gmail.com. I'm not here to fix anybody, but I am an ear. And I think people have done this for me, and I will do whatever I can to do that for others.
Thank you so much, JP. That's amazing. So runjprun@gmail.com if anybody would like to make direct contact with John Paul and talk about anything that came up for you during this interview.
Yeah,
and I think I love to look at, you know, powerful guiding questions. So I'd love to leave our audience as well with, you know, just reflecting on how you found resilience in your own life, what that means for you, how you found it, how you've nurtured it, and how you describe it and live it.
Hmm.
And JP, I'd like to thank you so very much for being here today. That was such a wonderful conversation. You're doing so many exciting things in the world, and I want to congratulate you on those achievements. I can't wait to look at your most recent, the book that you released last year and the one coming out as well. And I encourage all of the listeners to look up JP and learn some more about resilience.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I really, really, really enjoyed this, Elizabeth. Thank you so much.
Me too, JP. Thank you very much, and we'll be in touch. Thanks, everyone, for listening. You've been listening to Serving Consciously with Elizabeth Bishop and JP Bedard. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Serving Consciously with your host, Elizabeth Bishop. Consciously create your approach to work. Visit www.elizabethbishopconsulting.com. Join us on every second and fourth Friday at noon to continue rediscovering your passion.